Nothing I've been asking for alone. A small one. She told me that I was not economically viable. How'd your loan ever go? Did they give you a loan? He must be economically viable. There's a man with a smile on his face. He looks like a happy customer. That's what an economically viable person looks like. Economically viable. No.
Good morning, Winter Park. I'd like to welcome you to Punkonomics. And we have our host here, Dr. Benny Balick. And say hello.
Me again?
Yes.
Hello. We're adapting. We're adapting to the new board. We actually have a board here, a mixer that is younger than 40 years old.
Yes.
Kind of new.
I think it was born a couple months ago, maybe.
So that's pretty exciting.
Yeah,
in the distant, wonderful land of China, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. And we also have our guest for today, Chris Garlick.
Thank you.
And my name is Jesse. I'm the co-host of the show. And today we're going to talk about numerous things, including the war on drugs, and several other issues that are not currently being talked on the media. And we're going to start with the war on drugs.
I'll introduce, but I'm going to hand it over to Chris, because yesterday when somebody kind of requested the topic, asked a few questions online on Facebook in the Punkonomics page about it, you should have seen Chris just kind of spewed out a whole series of wonderful links, ranging from, you know, scholarly articles to a new quite intriguing movie called The House I Live In, I think, that just came out or recently, right?
Mm-hmm.
The trailer is definitely interesting, so it's there for you to check out. I'm going to take a little bit of a back seat this morning, I feel, maybe because I went out with an old buddy and alumni a little bit too late.
No, I'm envious. I should have gone out too.
My plans, I got senior seminar after this, going to listen to fascinating last of the three presentations. And then I think I plan to spend the rest of the day in my own form of wholesome digital Prozac, which is to play Fallout 3 on my Xbox until I pass out at some point. That's a wonderful game, by the way. Oh, I'm not supposed to endorse. So let's take it over to Chris and let's talk about the war on drugs and its economic implications and the prison industrial complex and its important and big and nasty story.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Balick. As you were saying, last night I asked my friends on Facebook, you know, what do you want us to talk about? And I got, several suggestions. One including, talk about, collusion between private industry and government. And I think this topic definitely is big on that, how basically the private prison system interacts with Congress in order to pass legislation and, all the lobbying that they do, and how that impacts lives. And what you're saying, the new movie, The House I Live In, by Eugene Jarecki, I saw an interview with him that he did with Jon Stewart the other week. That was very good. And basically, he got into it because he just wanted to see what the issues are, why black people are being held back. And he found that it boils down to the war on drugs. And basically the influence that the private industry system is now having on that.
That's a key. I mean, you know, us professors, we love the sound of our voice or something. You can't help. I mean, just to the big picture here, and I'll get it back to Chris with these details. That's really a big deal and important to me, I think, because I always try and focus on the stuff that is somewhat non-ideological, right? That we... in this show, really, and in class, everywhere, you know, because I think that's the hope that we can get together and solve our problems. So the fact that, you know, the right wing, actually, you know, you think, oh, there they are talking about racism, talking about prison, a bunch of lefties, right? But no, actually, the right wing, non-stooge, you know, hack, corporate, it starts with a W, I can't say it on the radio, precisely on top of this, importantly, that the government, their problem with government is not that just government bad, okay? They are that government is protecting business instead of policing it. That's what they call, the right wing, corporatism. And this is a real example of how 2.2 million people are getting grinded down in this new plantation holocaust that is our prison system. So, without further ado,
thanks. I mean, yeah, and one of the things that Drecki talked about is we're actually now seeing a a combined force, I guess you could say, between the right and the left against the drug war, and you know, and he gave the example, I guess, Grover Norquist. I was trying to find a quote of his, but I guess Grover Norquist is now on the side of reform.
He is,
you know, yeah, and so it's like, you know, how many issues do you have where Grover Norquist and someone like Russell Simmons or you know, people you normally find on the left that are on the same side of an issue? So, you know, he thinks that it's, you know, the days are numbered for the war on drugs. But but anyway, I wanted to talk about
it's all part,
you know,
of his
statistics.
Drowning the government in the
right.
Yeah, that's probably his angle. Yeah, we're spending too much money on this. So
drowning the government in a meth tub.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, no one's trying to argue that the government doesn't do things that
we
should spend money on.
Maybe he wants to go to California, get his little car so he can smoke pot.
Well, his record is so bad that we can't help but making all these cynical remarks. But at the same time, you know, if he's doing something positive, I'm open to anybody doing positive. I don't care for what reason.
Exactly.
I'm not Kantian, I'm utilitarian.
basically, you know, the regular arguments that are made is that, you know, after decades of this war, you know, drug use is in no way hindered or reduced. It's very easy to find, you know, drugs if you want to find them. Incarceration rates have gone up, but to what effect? You know, it doesn't appear to have any positive effect other than basically creating an industry. And that's what he says is the main obstacle in the path, is because there's so many jobs basically surrounding private prisons and the money that flows through those businesses to government. And you know, it's kind of nefarious, because if you think about it economically, if prisons are in the hands of private corporations, corporations that were, you know, the top two corporations in the industry, CCA and GEO, they make just over $2 billion a year. You know, incarcerating mostly nonviolent drug offenders. What is it? I saw a statistic here. Last year, 50.8% of federal inmates are incarcerated for drug offenses. Mm-hmm. And now the comparison to other offenses, you know, for robbery, it's 4.2%. For homicide and assault and kidnapping, it's 2.7%. And for sex-related offenses, it's 4.7%. So, you know, you have all these violent crimes, and drug incarcerations are way more than, you know, exponentially
but,
more.
But you know, that's an issue. That's a situation that's been happening for the last 30-something years. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can pretty much bring up what Maxine Waters was saying pertaining to Los Angeles. You know, in the Watts area, there is no poppy plants, you know, being harvested there. You know, the amount of drugs that is being panned around in L.A. Is just so outrageous that you kind of wonder where is it coming from. And the only way you can actually bring that kind of amount of drugs and weapons. It has to be sponsored by people with a lot of money. You know, back several years ago, it was somewhat publicized or known that the government was actually doing their little drugs for sale and be able to buy weapons because we're not supposed to negotiate with terrorists to release hostages. So we were going through the back door, you know, fueling.
Talking about Iran-Contra with,
exactly.
With the Reagan era.
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah. When you look at the demographics, you look at these stats, and you come around to the issue, now all of a sudden, all these corporations are going like, okay, well, you know, this is a bad business to be in, you know, doing drugs on the backside. Let's just go ahead and imprison these people, and that way we can make more profit. And
it's
look
a product
like
cycle,
good.
You know. Mm-hmm. And it's quite true. I mean, in fact, you could look it up. I think George Carlin actually had very funny situation where, you know, a very funny sketch has had many about that too, a long time ago, back in those days when. He kind of makes the comment that, in a funny way, I'm not going to try and channel him here, right? I'll say it dry. but that punishing gang members is silly, even if we are actually punishing real gang members, as was just mentioned. No, we're just grabbing people who can't pay for an expensive lawyer, the people populating the majority of our jails, not criminals. It's if you start punishing the bankers who are laundering the money, you know,
right?
Then and I remember even like years, decades ago, following this phenomenon because it's such a rotten phenomenon. And incidentally, you know, shout out to the economic profession. Usually, we don't have much to be proud about, but the economists overwhelmingly, right, left, center, up and down, are against this because it's so obviously rotten, mm-hmm. profoundly. But yeah, the big banks, the same, you know, the usual suspects have for 30 years been making billions off of laundering. All the drug money is laundered through New York City, not Bogota.
And then even when they get caught red-handed, you know, and the evidence is there and they plead guilty to it, the penalty for it, it doesn't even come close to what the profit that they made from it.
They usually don't plead guilty. You know how bank.
Oh, yeah. It's bank, like, no, like, contest.
No, I didn't do anything. I'll pay you $100 million, which is
true.
Barely the coffee budget.
And it boils down to a trip to a country club at the State Pen.
Exactly. Yeah.
But, I mean, let's also give, before we go back to some of this, a bit bigger picture, in case you don't realize that, you know, we have 2.2 million people. This is the highest proportion of the population incarcerated in the history of mankind. Mm-hmm. You know, my students will recognize this little shtick of mine. You know, much higher than Adolf Hitler or Joe Stalin ever incarcerated. Mm-hmm. Of course, statistically speaking, let us be honest, we don't kill them off as fast as those guys did.
Right.
You'll excuse my dark humor. You know, I'm really sensitive, so I have to protect myself with dark humor, right? seriously, actually, I'm not joking here. That's what I have to make. But I just want to make sure people don't think I'm making, like, jokes about Holocaust and extermination here because it's not funny. And this isn't funny either. So Chris was saying that these are majority drug offenders. There's a tremendous amount of demographic, racial injustice, economic racial injustice here. You know, a kid gets busted with some pot. You know, $300, I believe, in Winter Park, I was told, is what gets you from not spending the night in jail. And then a lawyer is very expensive, and a good lawyer, you know, yeah, you get a free lawyer, of course, but I understand some of them fall asleep drunk at
right.
the court. So again, if you are a member of the lower middle class and below, which most of us by definition are, then you're really screwed for reasons that are truly unnecessary. Beyond that, also, there's a lot of misconceptions that just recently learned, you know, so that most Americans, when you say drug dealer, who are they, the majority? And I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head. It's a teenage black kid, right?
Right.
That's one of the lowest demographics to be a drug dealer. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's a middle-aged white woman. Yeah, those are the real druggies in America. And I'm not even I'm talking about illicit list one. I'm not talking about the other big elephant in the room that the vast majority now of at least suffering from drugs, damaged from drugs. It's not crack. It's not heroin. It's prescription-branded medication that the kids find in their moms.
Mm-hmm. Or their grandmas.
Moms, or the grandmas or dad or whatever, in their parents, you know, legally purchased in most cases. Yet, you know, potentially very dangerous because kids, of course, within our consumer culture don't realize that two Percocets are like a dose of street heroin. Mm-hmm. Actually, Pura, probably.
Right.
But it's the same drug, artificially manufactured, with the same addiction, the same everything.
And you know, the problem also stems from the medical profession, too, because for the most part, let's say if you have any kind of mental issues or, you know, whatever problems you may have, you go to a doctor and right away they want to prescribe you a sedative to calm you down. You know, and then you get to see this therapist or doctor, you know, 2 months later, and they go like, oh, okay, let me refill this prescription and we'll talk about it later. And then by the time a year comes along, this person is addicted to the drug or maybe to something even else, because after a while, sedatives or those drugs, they tend to lose their effectiveness.
Yep, tolerance.
So what you have here is a culture of doctors, pharmaceutical companies actually being today's drug dealers, mm-hmm. you know, and bottom line, as you know, we live in a capitalist society, so it's all about profit.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, it is, I don't want to demonize that side of it too much, because that kind of is the model that legalization would have to look at. Mm. If, you know, legalization were to take hold, you know, we would have to look at how prescription drugs are being handled right now,
mm-hmm.
And the issues with those, and so that we were prepared to deal with that when, you know, if other drugs are made legal. I'm not saying there's no issues with legal prescription drugs, but it is something that we have to
keep
an eye on.
There's also a philosophical distinction in a sense, because I always thought, you know, and again, my views, they're not mainstream sometimes, you know. The problem is with primarily performance-enhancing drugs.
True.
It's a very different psychological phenomenon. I'm not, you're more qualified to see than I in psychology, other than my experience with psychos for 46 years. Somehow it's potentially healthier, I think, recreational. You see, I see a problem with kids taking amphetamines to study hard. No, you know, it's all right if with all the costs associated and dangers associated, if you do it to dance all night, you know, okay, be careful.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's a different addiction when, so, you know, drugs, whether legal or illegal, to solve your problems,
you're assigning a need to it in a regular habit, basically, yeah.
So a real legalization would be a recognition that people like to get wasted. They've been doing it for 40,000 years.
Right, and that is the truth.
There are better ways to do it and worse ways to do it. Of course, we don't even have to spell out, but everybody probably knows by now, you know, alcohol is the number one killer. We're not even talking about that.
Now, here's something to go back to your point about you know, kids being busted for a little bit of pot and paying $300 to get out of jail. A lot of people don't know, and actually I saw this the other night on Lawrence O'Donnell, where he was talking about that a year ago, the Obama administration had signed an extension of a law that basically what it boils down to is if somebody gets stopped and they perceive you to be a terrorist, they can withhold you indefinently. Also,
I believe kill you from the sky with a drone.
Well, I mean, not only that.
Step two.
But
Step two.
Supposedly, President Obama reluctantly signed this. Okay, I don't know how much arm twisting that was, because he is a conservative moderate, as far as I'm concerned. But the thing is, what is it to stop the next president, whoever that person might be, to take it even further to say, like, okay, he's listening to our programming. Maybe he thinks that we're a little bit too much on the radical side to say, oh, the Punkonomics is a bunch of terrorists. Yeah. Let's go ahead and toss them in jail.
We're going to be marked on the disposition
let's
matrix.
Let's not flatter ourselves, you know. I suppose if that happens, then we did our job well, you know.
But this is a topic that was brought up in the so-called presidential debate of the candidates that don't have a chance to win, mm-hmm. and I guess it was Larry King who was hosting that.
Larry King, yep.
And it's really unfortunate that the media, as well as both parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, are pretty much got it so tight together that it's almost a perception that there is no other parties. And, you know, for those that are listening out there is other choices out there, and they are actually on the ballot. All you have to do is just look up and see what they're about. And, you know, I know there's people out there that say, oh, you want to make a point, don't vote. Well, you know what? That does not work. I've been around for quite some time. I used to subscribe to that when I was back in university days. The truth of the matter is, that only works if half of the population or a little bit more than the population actually doesn't vote. And what you're going to have is then you have the people that actually vote will be in charge. So if you don't like the Republicans or you don't like Obama or whatever, don't waste your vote. Vote for somebody, you know, because eventually it's going to get to a point where a third party might emerge. I mean, why not? You know, it's there. You know, if anything, why are you going to let some tree get wasted just because you don't want to exercise your vote?
Yeah, before they put you in jail and you lose your vote.
Yeah, exactly.
That also kind of ties into you know, the war on drugs as well. You know, that how criminals are have this stigma, and in a lot of cases, they have restricted access to voting.
And overwhelmingly, so that, right? I mean, a few states they have a right to.
And so that's definitely a big obstacle in how, you know, in the lives of drug, you know, any kind of offender, really. But you know, more tragically, the nonviolent drug offenders who, you know, aren't really hurting anyone, and you know, their lives are changed dramatically after that. You know, post their incarceration. You know, they may be trying to put their lives back together, and they have all these things that they're restricted from doing. You know, also trying to, you know, when they try to get a job, there's a stigma attached to them because they are, a felon, or, you know, they have a criminal offense. And so that counts as a big point against them. And one of the big things that helps keep people away from doing, you know, harmful drugs is having a steady job and a reliable income and having something to work for, you know?
Right. Now, correct me here, or at least enlighten me on this, because I'm still in the California bubble, so... and believe me, it is a bubble, especially, you know, those of us that are from the Bay Area. Is it Florida that doesn't allow convicted criminals not to vote, or is it some other state?
Most states, Florida, absolutely. And you know what? This is a point to kind of just to make a... We'll do this in the near future, I think, or maybe we'll get there. It's our backup plan, but one of the tragedies is this is being used for electoral fraud. I mean, I just have to say it because it's really the thing that gets me all riled up over the past weeks, you know. Actually, over the past several years when we discovered about the mass fraud of the 2000, again, didn't make it much. All over the world, people were, like, snickering at America, you know. It was embarrassing. So one of the ways in which specifically, you know, blacks above all and increasingly Latinos are being disenfranchised is by claiming suspicion that they may have had a felony in another state and therefore they cannot vote. And by the time this is cleared up, the election is over. Mm-hmm. And we're talking, you know, hundreds of thousands by conservative measure in key states, of course, this is where it's done for obvious reason. And it's almost, you know, so it's just so revolting to me, so fundamentally unethical that I want to call out. And despite my attachment to being an equal opportunity hater, I cannot but say the truth. That you know the Republicans are, you know, we're attacking Acorn, and it was completely fabricated. It really just, you know, a little clip there that some guy made, and in fact it was reported, and they were
self-reported it. Yeah,
fully fabricated thing. Acorn is not fraudulent whatsoever. The current revolting racist attempt to disenfranchise people with this whole voter ID and we don't want fraud, where there's like 4 known cases in the past 50 years or something. Yet we have busted, no doubt, as much as the earth is round, that Karl Rove has been since stealing the election in 2000. 2004, the numbers are in, the analysis is done, you know. 2008, in fact, in Florida, at least over 800,000, the investigative journalist Greg Palast. Google that or look at the group or at the page I've been posting about him. Really check it out. He's been doing it since 2000 and even before. And right now, too. And even it has been now targeting South Carolina. Rove in the Wall Street Journal in an editorial discusses how he needs to basically beat the black vote in South Carolina by 0.5 percentage point to give South Carolina to to Romney. Even he's not spelling, and I'm going to do it with these unconstitutional, illegal, racist measures, which I'm a specialist at. This needs to be done, and don't worry, boys, I'm going to take care of it.
Right, right.
Hey, my God, where are we, you know?
I was looking up some stats on your question about the difference between Florida restriction and, you know, California restriction, and a good resource is the Brennan Center for Justice, which is out of the New York University School of Law. And so it shows the difference in states. And Florida is, in California, they have voting rights are restored automatically after release from prison and discharge from parole. People on probation are allowed to vote as well. They're similar to Colorado, New York, Connecticut, and South Dakota in that respect. It's a different color. Anyway, difference between them and Florida. Florida has is one of four states, along with Iowa, Virginia, and Kentucky, that has the most restrictive laws, and they have a permanent disenfranchisement for all people with felony convictions. The only exception is unless the government approves each individual's restoration.
Mm-hmm. Which government, state or federal?
It doesn't say, but I imagine it would be the state. It would be up to the state.
Just in case one of your buddies gets busted, basically. Clause, right?
Yeah,
right, right.
Yeah, there's a loophole for government employees, yeah.
No shame.
But the least restrictive that I've seen is in Maine and Vermont are the only two states that have no disenfranchisement at all for people with criminal convictions. So along the spectrum there, Maine and Vermont are, least restrictive, and meanwhile, Florida is on the same page as Kentucky with permanent disenfranchisement. So
yeah, and a lot of people, I think, they hear that and they go, "Wait a minute, maybe that's too much." After all, you know, because we have this image of all these like horrible predators, and of course, shall we talk about the media? You know, shall we talk about cops? Shall we talk about the image of the prison? You know, and who is in it? Remember what Chris told you—the facts. You know, over half of them are not violent criminals, just some.
And it's so easy for someone to fall into, you know, that course because of the incentives on. Involved in the drug war that law enforcement use to, you know, it's so easy to pick someone up and the monetary incentives there are high for them. You know, they get paid extra for, you know, taking these people in. So
well, you can go even on the higher levels. I mean, I remember back in the 70s when they started with the drug testing, and that was actually proposed by a Carter administration. And expanded.
Yeah, Carter was the pre-Reagan. Started Reaganism before Reagan was in power.
However, Reagan took it to a different level, though. You know, the whole concept of drug testing, it was supposed to be blanket. Everybody gets drug tested if you're in a safety-sensitive type of environment. Mm-hmm. Well, what happened was is that the ACLU and, you know, other people said, well, okay, if that's the case, then let's test the congressmen and the senators. And, whoa, you can't do that. even though, you know, we all know that they have the little parties and they smoke the little coke and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But, you know, let's be real. These are the people that actually make the decisions whether we go to war and obliterate a country. Right. You know, these are the people that are in charge of our lives. Now, if they're doing drugs and they're not being tested, what does that say about everybody else here?
It's the fakeness through to through, you know, from the kid that is told drugs are bad, but then sees so much around him, whether legal or illegal, to the sanctimonious, I am hard on drugs, middle-aged, insecure man in Congress.
Mm-hmm. And if the rationale being used is, you know, well, anyone, you know, for welfare recipients, right? There's a lot of support for welfare recipients because they're receiving, you know, government money. And so they want to make sure that it's not going to someone that's using drugs. Well, government employees are also receiving government money. You know, they're receiving taxpayer dollars for their salaries.
Everybody. And in fact, it seems that those who scream most against, oh, government's giving, take us, are the ones who get the most.
I know.
You know?
But yeah, I mean, speaking of Jimmy Carter, I mean, he was kind of one of the, I'm looking at an article here from IB Times, you know, one of the original proponents against the drug war. You know, basically, he just tries to lay out the stats of it, you know. And, he put forth some recommendations to address it. You know, first is to decriminalize possession of less than an ounce and add a full program to treat addicts. You know, the second is to remove the mandatory minimum sentencing and the three strikes or outlaw, which is terrible.
Ridiculous, for, right.
Yeah. Opportunity to remind us of just what a good word. Good. Can I say it's D-O-U-C-H-E? Maybe not. Let's not take a risk, shall we? But what a disappointing. Everybody, just like Reagan for the right, Clinton has been deified by the left. And so let's all settle down. Sure. You know, we have a lot to thank him for, in quotation marks. Including three strikes, you're out.
And then he, you know, eventually suggested experimenting with legal regulation in order to take away the power of organized crime and the incentives that basically prop up the industry. Because, I mean, you look at this and you see government and the prison industry on the same page as the big traffickers.
Right.
Big traffickers want to keep it illegal. Mm-hmm. They're not trying to keep it, you know, they're not trying to make it legal. They're making tons of money because there's so much risk involved in it.
And, you know, it was the same attitude with prohibition. You know,
we already have an example in U.S. history that spanned, you know, several years.
Though it's tiny. But, you know, that allows me, this prohibition comparatively, the damage. And, I mean, you can even look at foreign policy, by the way, with the war on drugs. I mean, we're exporting mass amounts of violence and problems into Latin America that are, by the way, finally also pushing back. So I must say, you know, to all your potheads out there, the constellations is probably more favorable than ever before. There might be, like you started, some kind of consensus about it. Though the reason why I'm still skeptical. I used to say for years that the day drugs will be legalized, it'll be the day where the pharmaceutical industry can brand them and charge monopoly prices for them.
Yeah, agreed. I think it's definitely a process changing the power from moneyed interests to other moneyed interests. I guess you could say, because the main obstacle is obviously moneyed interests, special interests keeping it illegal. But if we were to somehow make it, you know, incentivize it to other interests, maybe that would help.
Though it seems to be difficult, and here to go back to prisons, maybe you can deal with the pharmaceutical industry that way. But what do you deal with? What is all this private prison, the bonanza of being taking our tax money and locking up and torturing people for it?
They definitely do a lot of lobbying, not just in favor of drug-related things, but also immigration-related things. You know, they have contracts with the federal government, these top prison groups, to detain, you know, suspected, you know, illegal immigrants.
By record amounts right now?
Mm-hmm. And so they push this legislation, $45 million, spent on lobbying, and then they rake in billions of dollars in contracts. And, you know, economically, it's not good to have private prisons. I mean, sure, let's have prisons, but have them under public control. Because when you put things privately, you know, what's this? Look at the supply and demand. What's the demand, you know, that these prisons are receiving? You know, it's prisoners.
Right.
And so what are companies going to do to increase their demand? They're going to try and get, in this case, more prisoners. Mm-hmm. So they're going to push, they're going to have all this lobbying to have, you know, make it easier for people to be imprisoned. They're going to push legislation to make it, you know, longer sentences so that they have more demand. And it's
let's
so
mention again, because there are all these peripheral phenomenons to this, but a big scandal in some circles of stop and frisk, most notably in New York, where again if you look right, and that means you're not Lily White, Then you can just, let's just stop you and search you. And, you know, you find little things here and there, like everybody.
Sure.
And there, but that gives you the right to unconstitutional, but highly popular among, in these circles.
Yeah, and a
profitable,
lot of cases.
Profitable, above all, right?
Mm-hmm. But, you know, let's also look from the employer side. I mean, the drug testing, going back to the drug testing, drug testing is not 100% accurate. Okay. Actually, talking about being disenfranchised, minorities, because of the pigment, the melanin in the skin, actually will trigger that test to become positive. And what's
wasn't
happened,
that Seinfeld episode? And she eats a lot of like poppy bagels and then
right.
Well,
you, you will actually have to eat tons
a lot
of poppy. But the problem with that is that in that situation, the employee is actually guilty until proven innocent. And what happens is, let's say from a safety, you know, a point of view, you know, airline or transportation, what happens is that that person gets right away ejected. You know, and of course, this is also very disingenuous because there's been cases where pilots have been completely drunk. I mean, almost staggering down through the jetway. And yeah, sure, they pull them over and they find them, but they've gone to their training. You know, a year later, they're back flying. Now, an employee that comes out positive for pot is completely ejected, cannot go anyplace else. Needless to say, that they cannot go to another safety-sensitive environment. Needless to say also is that because you come out positive on the test, from there down, you basically have to pay all your lawyer fees. You have to pay for any subsequent tests. So it's not like they're actually going like, okay, maybe this test wasn't right at first. Let's go and retest you, you know, or let's see what else is going on here, because other medications do have negative interactions that also will make these tests come up positive. And, you know, if you really want to look at being disingenuous too, you know, state of California, okay, and of course, a lot of people say that we're, you know, on top of things, we're the first to start things, but yeah, California is also conservative for you people out there that think that we're a bunch of nuts out there and that we just do things out of the clear blue. Right now, and for those Obama supporters, which I also am an Obama supporter, the administration has actually closed down more medical marijuana clinics than the Bush administration, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. The Obama administration has also deported more people because of the legality of their citizenship than the Bush administration. So if any right wing is to say that Obama has been lax on drugs and, you know, ejecting people, or, you know, of course, Romney wants to describe to self-deportation, I still have not met one Latino or anybody from a different country that's here illegally that is going to self-eject themselves from the country. That's got to be the most dumbest thing I've ever heard. But going back to what's going on in California is a lot of these clinics, and we're talking about clinics that actually help people who have these illnesses. You're talking about AIDS, they're in chemotherapy, and marijuana does work for them. But because these pharmaceutical companies have a tight niche on their drugs for chemotherapy or whatnot, they're just really pushing and lobbying in Congress to completely eliminate something that holistically has been proven to help people. They just want to keep it illegal so they can fill their pockets full of money.
Most things, I mean, in a sense, economics teaches us that, especially economic history, institutional economics. In fact, okay, let me give myself a plug. I have a paper on this, actually, in a law journal, where we study how 50,000 British convicts were transported to the to American colonies at the time and worked to death as disposable labor in worse conditions than even slaves. And that's a lot of people for the 1700s, like millions, if you transpose it today. Really to get rid of them, to put them out of the system where they were not being productive, there were no jobs for them, you know. And we go through in the paper, like 50 pages or something. One of my favorite papers, my good buddy Jonathan Lave. The incentives at every level, the government is making a good deal, the jailers are making a good deal, the shippers are making a good deal, and in fact we show that they have profit rates that were well above slaving. The only reason that stopped was 1776, you know, didn't want anymore. And that's when, incidentally, a much more famous phenomenon only started, of sending convicts to Australia, because Australia was much more expensive. The whole beautiful, all of those incentives, all of those revenue streams coming together, as Chris was describing earlier, with, you know, the prison getting paid, the police department getting paid. I mean, they don't get paid cash by the head so much, but they get budgets, they get support, they get perks. The politicians getting paid, the bankers getting paid, everybody getting paid. And who suffers? The mass amounts of incarcerated people. Let me throw a statistic, one of those nice statistics out there. You know, every eighth prisoner on the planet Earth is an America and is an African American. Every eighth prisoner, you know, China, all those nasty places, not really. Another thing, our prisons are horrible. We have this view that, oh, our prisons are nice. It's not like being a, you know, you have this show on television. I never watched it because these things get make me angry, but, you know, prison abroad or something, you know. No, you do better in most other prisons abroad, you know. A majority of prisoners are subjected to what, according to international law, is torture, such as solitary confinement that makes you go crazy with pretty quickly. A host of horrible, again, perceptions, and we have these literally these ghost slave ships with 2.2 million of American citizens being tortured in. And then what Jesse was saying, how about the rest of us? In employment, we have no rights. Basic human rights, you know? How come people who call themselves conservatives sometimes, well, not all, you know, so, everybody together here, you know? How can you allow the fact that your employer has access into your body? What the hell is that?
Right.
You know, what next? You know, go into work, you know, metal detector, full cavity search. Yeah, friends, that is next.
That is. Yeah, that is next.
It's almost here already, isn't it? Yeah, we should be outraged by this.
I wanted to hit on something that you mentioned in passing there is, you know, it's another externality of the drug war is what happens to people once they get incarcerated, once they're in prison. In a lot of cases, it doesn't hinder their ability to run their drug operation. And also, they make a lot more customers. You know, right. They meet more people. And, they either meet customers or they meet, future coworkers.
And sometimes they become lawyers.
That's true.
You have to. I mean, yeah, you have the prisoners who, you know, spend their time in the library and often
become better criminals.
And that's
Mumia Abu-Jamal, for example, you know, sitting in death row for decades despite being almost surely innocent.
But yeah, I mean, it's you know, in some cases, big drug kingpins, they're happy to go to prison because then, you know, they have an ability to, you know, kind of be king while in there. They're safe from outside, you know, external I'm trying to think of the word, but, you know, just they're safe from other bad things that would happen to them on the
right.
Outside.
Exactly. And it's also a recruitment center for them, too.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
Those are the ones that are leaving a prison, hence are going to go out and take care of their little territories for the person that's in there. That's kind of wheeling and dealing and manipulating the
And once
whole
you
system.
Go in, I mean, you got to hook up with somebody because you can't be alone in prison. In fact, that also, I think, reflects to another illusion, taboo lie that we say to poor people in America that, you know, stay in school, you know, get a job, really, you know. That's just not rational. That's silly.
Right.
If you're living in the ghetto, get into a gang.
Right.
That's the only who's going to get you back? And I want to say, I mean, as a foreigner, everywhere.
It does make sense on a certain level to have that social support structure.
Everybody needs some kind of social support or support structure. If we don't have others, then that's it. And that's also insightful, I think, in many cases for foreign policy, where we wonder, you realize, I don't know, let's use an example of Palestinians in Gaza. I'm not even going politically about it. Purely a human question. Why do they support a Muslim fundamentalist group that is on the American terrorist list, a group known as Hamas, you know? The vast majority of them don't agree with any of the policies of Hamas, certainly not those missiles they lob and then get bombed the hell out in punishment. Certainly most of them not the strict religious doctrines or anything like that. Palestinians are extremely secular, relatively, or at least used to be, less and less. But the main thing to say is that the vast majority of them support them because when their baby is hungry, and hunger is like 70% in Gaza, who's going to get you formula?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Hamas will.
Who's got, yeah.
You know? Nobody else will.
One of the very few groups that has their backs. So.
And out there, you know, parents, you know, somebody gives you food for your baby when they're crying hungry, they got your vote.
Right.
Forever.
Exactly. And that's definitely a good comparison to what's happening here in the ghettos. You know, and disenfranchised communities, you know, and particularly, I gotta say, I mean, it's not because I'm Latino, but when I've gone back up to New York and seen some of the boroughs where it's predominantly Latino, I mean, you can tell that somehow, even though the state of New York or New York City has tried to bring everybody up, you know, they just completely shunned. you know, the Latino community. They have completely shunned the black community. And actually, in Manhattan alone, they've pushed out a lot of the minorities just to be able to bring in the corporate, you know, people and the rich. It's just really ridiculous.
When you think about people's, you know, future productivity and their potential, if people feel like they're being targeted, you know, for little to no reason, it's going to damper their, you know, their outlook on being, you know, a positive influence, you know, and working, you know, helping the public sector, you know, and being, you know, working with law enforcement on actual important things that they're working on. I see that we're running out of time. I just want to hit on, we talked about, you know, money interest. I actually want to put some figures on what we're spending on the drug war. And this is, you know, I have figures here for, you know, money spent on the war on drugs just this year. Total has already been spent as of, you know, Friday, October 26th, $33.5 billion has been spent on the drug war. And, you know, when you think about
money.
Yeah, and that's your taxpayer money.
Right.
And, you know, what's the use that it's going to? If we were to decriminalize or legalize and divert resources away from this, which is virtually a useless activity, and towards actually positive things.
Like education.
Yeah, education and treatment programs. I mean, I think it's you know, I'm sure there's a handful of people out there that think, you know, it is possible to have, you know, get rid of all drugs and have nobody on them. But most people that are involved in this,
they're probably on drugs.
exactly.
But most people recognize that we will never have a drug-free world. And so the best option is to, if you're going to put money into this, put resources, put it into treatment programs. Make it safe. So that, you know, other negative externalities, people getting diseases from, you know, from tainted syringes or, you know, what have you. But even the money saved and redirected to positive activities, think of how much additional revenue that local governments and state governments and federal governments could make if it were to be legalized as well. So this is what I would think, a big swing in resources that, you know, would help out a lot of different areas.
Well, Washington thought so.
Well, there's global global consensus, by the way. I mean, really, all experts in all fields, with few strange exceptions, are against the drug wars and for some degree of legalization, gradual or otherwise. In every academic field, and even the basically everybody's not getting paid directly by this phenomenon. Cops on the beat, you know, overwhelmingly are against this too.
Mm-hmm. The organization LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition.
But then, you know, I mean, since we the key here, and this is key for policy on every topic. Look, we sat around, there's pretty good consensus about what needs to be done, that this is not working, even whatever your goals are, even if you want to, like you said, eradicate drugs, this isn't doing it. So if you want to do that, better try something else, et cetera, et cetera. But the problem, and again, this is for everything, is that people are getting paid. Right. The decision makers, above all, are getting paid, are in on this. So we talk until we're blue in the face about what should be done for the American public, for those 306, a student corrected me the other day, million Americans. But that's not what the decision, that's not the criteria for the decisions being made. The decisions being made are for a very, very small subsection of those people. Mm-hmm. And Adam Smith was hoping back, you know, a father of modern economics, was hoping that these powerful, rich gentlemen will care ethically about the other 99.99% of the population.
First mistake.
That was, maybe he didn't see just how corrupt, he didn't get just how much power corrupts. Maybe, I don't know.
Well, and for this discussion, you know, I'm sure the people out there are probably going like, oh, you know, what do we do? I'm so frustrated. So I'm going to play a tune here, and I'm sure that after listening to us rant away about the war on drugs, maybe the Ramones can bring us some light. And there's one particular tune that I'm sure all you people out there can identify with. And I definitely want to thank our guest, Chris Garlick, and our host, Benny Balak. And, of course, I am Jesse Velez, co-host of Punkonomics. And here you go, the Ramones. Have a great day, everybody. And, again, if you're out partying, make sure that you don't run into the car with the disco lights on, because you're going to spend a long time in jail.